When I was 16, I sniffed my first bag of heroin. And, you know, I dabbled in it here and there. When I was just about to be 20, I started shooting it, you know, and off to the races.
Eric is a heroin addict. He lives on the streets of a major American city, Philadelphia. His story is one of many from the front lines of America's opioid crisis. Hello, welcome to Plugged In. I'm Greta Van Susteren, and every day an average of 115 Americans die from an opioid overdose. Opioids are a class of drugs that include illegal drugs such as heroin, but they also include legal pain relievers such as oxycodone. And studies show, however, that 21 to 29% of patients prescribed opioids for chronic pain misuse them, and 80% of heroin users first misused prescription drugs before they became addicted to heroin. The result is an addiction epidemic, and this epidemic has taken a giant toll on Americans. Voice of America's new documentary series, The Damage Done, records the devastation of the opioid epidemic.
In the blink of an eye, you can get caught up. And if you've been addicted, or you are addicted, it's a battle for your soul. To stay alive every day and to not have something bad happen to you. Here I am, lost everything I own again. I'm not going on another year or two run. I don't have it in me. I got tore up so quick, and it just keeps getting worse and worse and worse, and I can't do this anymore.
I started my civilian law enforcement career in Rocky Mount, North Carolina, 20 years ago. I worked narcotics for almost 8 years. About 5-6 years ago, I became the chief of police in the town of Nashville. That's got me intrigued. What I'm used to from a police perspective is people don't want to engage in conversation, or they turn around and walk the other way. Around here, it's just the opposite. Hello! People say hi, and they want to know how your day is.
Not a problem. Yes, sir.
Small towns have that charm that I really think help a lot. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Have a good one.
The opioid epidemic here in Nash County has hit us pretty hard. It's swept in here pretty rapidly and has affected a lot of people. Nashville is not a hub for distribution of heroin, but we have users here, obviously. In the United States, almost 114 people every day lose their lives in the opioid epidemic. A little closer to home in North Carolina here, we lose almost 4 every day. And then in Nash County, we've lost a number of individuals. In case you haven't heard of the HOPE Initiative, in a nutshell, it is an angel program that allows individuals that have a substance use disorder to come down to our police department. If they have any drugs or paraphernalia on them at any time, I tell them, turn it over to me. I'm not going to ask you any questions. And we do not charge them with a crime. And we take them in and get them on the path to recovery. Rather than try to pass the buck and allow somebody else to help those individuals, the police are now doing that.
In the year 2016, more than 40,000 Americans died from opioid overdose. Now, that number is more than a 25% increase in opioid deaths in the U.S. from the year before. And since 2002, opioid deaths in the United States have more than doubled. Yes, the epidemic of opioids in the United States is raging. But this epidemic is also growing in other countries around the world. So what is causing the spread of addiction, and how can we stop it? Today you will hear from Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi, who is on the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction. And you will hear from a man who will tell you his agony of opioid addiction and withdrawal. But first, we are joined by Washington Post national reporter Katie Zesma. She covers drugs, guns, gambling, and vice in America. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
All right. This problem, it's safe to say, has exploded in this country.
Yeah.
But tell me, when did this begin to explode?
So, you know, opium and heroin has been a problem for millennia. We had the opium wars, you know, centuries ago, and in the 1970s there was, you know, heroin. But what happened in 1996 was OxyContin was released. It's a painkiller, and it was used around the country. So what you saw was people getting addicted to these painkillers that came out, you know, from the late 1990s up through the 2000s. And people really started to pay attention in, you know, the mid-2000s, and there were crackdowns on these pills. Law enforcement started to try and get these pills off the street. They cracked down on them. They became much, much harder to use. But at the same time, you had a lot of people who were addicted. So what they did was they then turned to heroin, which the cartels came in and put a lot of heroin on the street, and it was readily available. So as people could not get pills, they turned to heroin and were able to get that. And now what we're seeing is, you know, as law enforcement has gone after heroin, these synthetic drugs are coming in. Fentanyl, which is a very, very powerful synthetic opioid, is now on the street. Things that are even more powerful than that, carfentanil, which is an elephant tranquilizer, which a few specks can kill someone, are now out on the street. So you kind of have this storm of all of these drugs that are out there now and, you know, millions of people who are addicted to them.
Now, OxyContin, you said, came about 1996. We want people who have pain to have relief from pain.
Yes.
We don't want people to suffer. Prior to 1996, was there no effective pain treatment? And is OxyContin such a better method to treat actual pain? Forget the addiction side.
Well, it was, you know, it kind of took, there were plenty of pain options. There was fentanyl, is actually used in hospitals still. It was made in the late 1950s, early 1960s. Morphine has always been, an option. But this was something, a pill form that you could give to people to take at home. So that was the difference. It wasn't administered in a hospital setting. It was something that people could actually take at home.
Now, the FDA, which is the Food and Drug Administration, is the government agency that okays drugs, among other things. Did they okay the pill form of OxyContin, and what have they been doing for the last 10 or 15 years?
Well, yeah, so they did that, and then, you know, starting in the late, you know, 2010 or so, they approved a non-crushable form of it. So, there have been a number of drugs for pain relief that have been out there as well, and they have all come up through the FDA.
What struck me is an article that you wrote in the Washington Post, and this is in May, and the headline was, "Drug Executives Express Regret Over Opioid Crisis. One tells Congress his company contributed to the epidemic." You know, it's the suggestion that perhaps drug executives, I mean, at least from that, is that how could you not know this was happening? Because included in the article is the fact that two small pharmacies in the state of West Virginia, which has a population of only 1.8 million, there were 12.3 million doses to one family discount drugstore between 2006 and 2014, and 9 million to a pharmacy in a town. 9 million to a pharmacy in a town that only had 400 people living there.
Yeah, so this is data that is kept by the Drug Enforcement Administration. It's called ARCOS data, and it shows kind of where the pills go from manufacturer to the actual pharmacy. And the way that they get there is they're manufactured by these companies, and then they are distributed by companies that actually do drug distribution. So right now, Congress has questioned the head of these distribution companies, wondering how they were able to send all of these pills to these towns without raising red flags with the federal government and saying, hey, this looks suspicious. And then they are now looking to question the manufacturers of these pills, essentially going to ask them the same questions. How was this able to happen?
But see, you know, in my mind, I said, how does a town of 400 people need 9 million pills for pain relief? I mean, if that isn't a red flag to the drug distributor, the drug manufacturer, the FDA, the DEA, the Drug Enforcement Administration, and these drugs are, that's just one small part of the country.
Mm-hmm. And that's a question that people want to know now, is why were these not flagged? Why were additional steps not taken? And the distributors have said, you know, it comes with prescribing practices, or maybe, for instance, a VA hospital that may need more pills, there may be doctors who are requesting more of them. But the question that people really want to get to the root to is, how did a town of, you know, not only 400 people get millions of pills?
It's incredible. Katie, thank you for reporting.
Thank you.
U.S. President Donald Trump vowed to battle this crisis. He created the President's Commission on Combating Drug Addiction and the Opioid Crisis. Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi is on that presidential commission. She joins us from Tampa, Florida. Nice to see you, General.
You too, Greta.
You know, you and I have known each other for a very, very long time, and let me confess now is that for years and years and years and years, when we were prosecuting before the Attorney General, You were the first one to start telling me about this problem and pointing it to Florida, and you didn't stop talking about it, and I thought, I wish I had paid more attention to you.
Thank you. Thank you. And I can answer your last guest's question about why that amount of pills was going to a tiny town of 400 people, too.
And what is the answer?
The answer is because it's coming in through the U.S. Post Office. DEA, they are doing their best to crack down on it. There are some still under investigation where almost a kilo of fentanyl that could kill a million people also went into a tiny town. They're going in there through the post offices because they think they're getting in the country, and they are. And then they're being picked up by the dealers and being distributed everywhere. That's my opinion on what's happening.
Well, is there some way to, what's the solution? Because I know people talk about treatment centers, but you're already, at that point, you're addicted and you've lost your job, your home, your fans and family. But if it's, mm-hmm. if it's coming in starting with the post office, you know, what's the remedy there? And I'll get to the
That's
drug
the remedy.
Companies too.
Well, the post office.
What can they do? I mean, you deliver a package to the post office. How do you know what's in it?
Well, they need to start tracking them, especially if they're coming in from China, because that's where the black market fentanyl, and hopefully we can talk about that in a minute, but that's where the fentanyl is coming into our country. And the packages, suspicious packages, things need to be looked at. And that's in Rob Portman has led. Portman has legislation. He's done a great job on trying to do that and revamp our postal service. And I've talked to General Kelly about it, and I know he is on board with that as well as the president.
Well, you say
that was one of the many recommendations of the Opioid Commission.
All right. You talk about the black market, but even here in the United States, the
yes.
non-black market in the year 2010, it's a $3.1 billion industry. That's a lot yes. that's a lot of money. So it's, you know, so It's not just a black market. We're doing it ourselves.
We sure are. I'll tell you, in my state still, we have about at least 15 people dying a day. You know, and if we keep at that rate with 150 to 175 people a day in our country, every family in America is going to know someone touched by this crisis. So it's like you said, we've got to hit it at all fronts. And of course, I'm a career prosecutor, so enforcement, crackdown, get these things off the streets, that's so important. But we've got to start at the very front, such as the post office, such as education to kids, because these drugs are taking these crazy new forms now. And, you know, practically every year, Greta, since I've been in office, you know, in 2011, 3 months after I got elected, we went in and cracked down on those pill mills. You know, it was basically a drive-through pharmacy where you didn't even see a doctor. So we cracked down on those in Florida. But then you've got these crazy synthetic drugs. So we've done, I've signed over, I think, 133 emergency orders to get the synthetic drugs, which are basically oxycodone, all the different drugs, but in a synthetic form, off the streets. We have a neonatal task force, because this is something I did not learn until I felt like, wow, we really got these pill mills. We're getting them off the streets. And a doctor from St. Joseph's Hospital in Tampa, Dr. Solomon, they called me and said, we have another problem, the babies. Babies are being born exposed to oxycodone. And so our legislature in Florida gave us almost $10 million reoccurring to start a council to try to help educate pregnant women about that. You would think that women would know when you're pregnant, but they don't. Some OBGYNs will tell us, Dr. Solomon, that women will come in and say, well, I smoked marijuana, but I've stopped that. I've stopped drinking alcohol. But they won't say they're taking oxycodone because they think it's a prescription. And I went and saw these babies. Their incubators have to be covered in blankets. They're sensitive to light, to touch, to sound. Instead of milk, they're coming into this world getting morphine or methadone.
You know,
that's how frightening it is.
I started this conversation about saying how I've known you for years. You've been talking about this longer than anybody else before I even realized, you know, what a crisis it is. But here we've got a drug executive testifying before Congress in May that he has regret over the opioid crisis as though he's just learned about it. I mean, I realize the black market, we've got to stop the stuff coming in from other nations. But, I mean, these people who are manufacturing them, and I want people to have the pain taken care of. I don't want anybody to suffer. But
Absolutely.
These numbers are just, I mean, it's disgraceful that you have 9 million to 400 people in one country. And I cannot believe that the drug executives who manufacture this are just learning about this in May,
That's right.
when apparently people are dying left, right, and center, and you've known about it for decades.
And that's why, Greta, we're part of a 41-state, multi-state investigation that's still going on. But in Florida, as the third largest state in the country, and the tremendous problem we face, I have sued five of the largest manufacturers. Purdue, of course, is the largest, Allergan, five of them. But also four distributors, Cardinal, McKesson, AmerisourceBergen, and Mallinckrodt. So I've sued four distributors and five manufacturers for a lot of different things.
All right, explain to me, because I didn't realize until I dug into this, you've got manufacturers of the drugs, but then the distributors. I always thought the manufacturers distributed it.
No, they don't. And you recognize, of course, the big names, Purdue for the manufacturers. One of the biggest names in the distributors is Cardinal Healthcare. And what they're doing is that the manufacturers are misrepresenting by omission. And we also have found, and this is alleged in our pending lawsuit, that they have front organizations that they funded basically encouraging people about the use of opioids and how good it is to take. The distributors, they failed to assess and evaluate their customers. If they saw suspicious packages and they've been hit with fines before, they wouldn't report it. And they've been hit with fines for not reporting, and some of them. And then they would, when they knew something was suspicious, they would still continue to deliver to these people. And there's much more than that, but that's the basics of the lawsuit.
All right. If they misrepresent, is there a risk? You know, we have civil suits in this country for damages, but if there's someone misrepresenting, you know, the impact or the addictive nature of it, is there potential for a criminal investigation?
Well, we've charged them with civil racketeering. We've charged them with unfair and deceptive trade practices. We've charged them, of course, in civil court. There's a potential for that. I think we're going to hit them the hardest the way we're doing it. We have a very comprehensive lawsuit. We have excellent outside counsel assisting our attorneys because of the volume. It's going to be just time-consuming. And these my attorneys and our outside counsel, they're working around the clock on this, going all over the country. And they need to these manufacturers and distributors, we still want them to come to the table and do the right thing, because we need money from them for education, for restitution, and to fund beds.
All right,
to help people.
All right, so the black market, I understand, they're made, you know, not by a manufacturer, they come in from overseas, but are our U.S. manufacturers of the drugs, are they shipping them overseas so that we are exporting our crisis as well to other parts of the world?
That is not part of our lawsuit. Our lawsuit, of course, is only what's happening, and that's what I have proof of happening in our country. But people also need to look out for heroin and fentanyl being laced in a pill form, and it sometimes looks like a Xanax or an Adderall. What's that? The drug of choice for college kids. So people need to be really careful.
And at the same time, we also don't want people to suffer from pain. You know,
never.
I mean, people think that when you have this discussion about opioids, that you want to make people who do have pain, that we want them to suffer for that. That's not this discussion, is it?
Exactly. And we need to protect our pharmacies who have large amounts that they're selling because they're right next to a cancer hospital. Absolutely.
So tell me the good news. I mean, are we going to get a grip on this crisis?
You know, Greta, I feel like sometimes I'm on a hamster on a wheel that just when you, or whack-a-mole, just when you think you've got one thing covered, something else happens. And with technology and synthetic drugs, and now I never dreamed I'd see heroin in a pill form instead of a needle. But yes, what we're doing, we're trying to fund more treatment centers. We've got to have treatment. We've got to have education. And now we have a lot of great people. Governor Scott cares so deeply about this issue. The president formed a commission on it, and President Trump been working very hard in the White House to tackle all of these problems, and it's bringing awareness to it as well. But we have a long way to go. We know that.
Attorney General Pam Bondi from the state of Florida, thank you for joining us. And again, I should have listened to you so long ago that I can't believe it. You told me this 10, 15 years ago. So thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Greta.
Opioid abusers often get addicted to opioids from pain management for an injury or an illness. Now, this happened to Allison, who spoke to Voice of America.
I started smoking pot when I was about 18. I was 19 when I met my husband. He kind of introduced me to oxycodone. I got in two car accidents back to back, and I went to a doctor. You have doctors that are called pain doctors. They go from prescribing nothing to prescribing a very powerful opioid. I have court for shoplifting. My greatest fear is going on probation and losing my job.
Ma'am, so this is the offer that they're making to you. It's either pretrial diversion, which is usually a course that can be like 4 to 12 hours depending on the course. The other offer, if you don't want to take the class, is a withhold of adjudication, court cost. What would you like to do today?
I'll do the pretrial diversion.
Pretrial diversion?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, perfect.
I'm grateful for the outcome. This could have been a lot worse. This is kind of best case scenario, and it's not something that I ever thought would happen, but I'm grateful it didn't.
The extreme difficulty of withdrawal keeps users such as Allison hooked. Travis Reeder is a bioethicist at the Johns Hopkins Berman Institute. And like Allison, he experienced the horrors of opioid addiction and withdrawal as he struggled to recover from a motorcycle accident and several foot surgery. He joins us. Nice to see you.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate it.
Pain is a real issue. You had pain from several surgeries?
Yeah, that's right. And, you know, I was listening to your early segments. I think that the way you're framing this is so important that we don't want people to suffer. And the fact that we're talking about opioids doesn't mean we think they're evil. So I'm kind of the poster child for that. I had my foot blown apart in a motorcycle accident. I had genuine, acute, severe post-traumatic pain. I needed medication. I needed pain management. But I didn't have it managed well over the long term. And that was the problem.
All right. So tell me what happened. You got your first prescription and what happened?
Well, so it's much more complicated than that often in surgeries and trauma. It's not one prescription. I was in three different hospitals. I had dozens of clinicians seeing me. So morphine, fentanyl, Dilaudid, pills of oxycodone, Oxycontin, as we talked about, going home between surgeries. And there was no one steering the ship. And every time the pain got worse, every time I got behind the pain, which is something clinicians talk about, they upped my dose. And tolerance is a very real phenomenon with opioids. It very often pretty quickly is going to require a higher dose to keep the same level of pain at bay. And so I continued up the dose.
When did you have sort of the thought, or maybe you didn't, that you were addicted?
Never. And there's an interesting component here to talk about terminologically. I still don't think that I was addicted. And so now I've become a researcher in this field. What I certainly wrestled with was a profound dependence, meaning that my body had become accustomed to it. My brain and my central nervous system had become accustomed to the drug. And when it was taken away, I then went into severe withdrawal. But addiction is something
more. Not pain with your foot necessarily, but something more systemic, the withdrawal. I mean, tell me what it's like.
Exactly. So basically no one gave me good advice on how to taper opioids, which is a really crucial skill that physicians need to have.
And you've got a big deal. You got a big job. I mean you're not, you know, it's not someone who's not without access to health care.
I'm really fortunate, and that's what makes my story scary, because I work at Johns Hopkins, I'm friends with clinicians, I have a lot of advantages, I have a really supportive family. I had everything going for me, which is probably why I don't feel like I wrestled with addiction, and who knows what genetic fortunes I have. But when I was cast into withdrawal, because no one told me how to taper my medications, what happened was, sure, the pain comes back, and all over pain, and severe flu symptoms. But,
well, that's the withdrawal, the severe flu symptom, right?
So a lot of it is withdrawal. So hyperalgesia, increased sensitivity to pain, is also part of withdrawal, which is part of the real darkness of this mechanism, because if you stop taking the opioids, your body's going to tell you that you need more of them because you become uncomfortable with flu-like symptoms and eventually, for me, mood disorder, depression, but also just severe pain rebounds. And that hyperalgesia can really make you think, oh, I need to go back on the medications.
And of course, you did.
Well, so I slowly, over the course of a month, not slowly enough, but I continued to drop the medication, and I didn't, in fact, go back on the medication. I made it out, and what that makes me is lucky.
You know, and you are lucky, because, you know, so many people, they lose their family, they lose their jobs, and it's like, you know, by the time they get to treatment, like in some treatment center of some sort, they've lost everything.
Yeah,
they've
exactly.
lost everything. Anyway, thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo recently traveled to Singapore for the ASEAN Ministerials, where he met with the leader of Burma. Secretary Pompeo tweeted after that meeting, "At the ASEAN Ministerials, I spoke with Burma's minister, Kwal Tin, and raised U.S. concerns about two Reuters reporters detained in Burma for doing their job. They should be released immediately." Now, those two Reuters journalists were arrested while investigating allegations of the massacre of Rohingya Muslims. Reports are that the two journalists were handed by police illegal documents, and then the police immediately arrested the journalists for possession of those documents. The two journalists have been in jail since December. They are scheduled for final arguments in court in 2 weeks. If convicted, the two journalists face up to 14 years in prison. That's all the time we have for today. Stay plugged in by liking us on Facebook at Voice America. You can also like my Facebook page at facebook.com/Greta and follow me on Twitter at Greta. Thank you for being plugged in.
I'm Jim Malone, and I work the political beat. I cover what drives the political issues in the United States, what voters think, what drives the candidates, how public opinion shifts on one issue or another. It keeps you in touch with the American people and where they want the country to go. It's a great way to get a window on what's happening in the United States. I'm Jim Malone, and my beat is U.S. politics.
I'm Jeff Selden, and I work the National Security Beat. National Security Beat is anything that affects the national security of the United States, from counterterrorism to surveillance to even relations with Russia. It's one of the most fascinating beats you can have. It's probably one of the more important beats that you can cover because it touches on so many areas of the world, so many areas of people's day-to-day lives. I'm Jeff Selden, and my beat is National Security.
My name is Eva Marcan. I started working at VOA in 1998. We're originally from former Yugoslavia, so we moved to America right when the war started. In 91, when I came here, in class I would always spend a lot of time doodling with wall art, graffiti. It opened up the door to exploration for a teenager. But you can definitely come out and do a piece like this, or do a piece like this, and it would be recognized. And you also tell a story through it. I connect art with journalism because it's a story that changes. And it's not just a view, it's not just a personal perspective, it's a story. And it's a story to be told. And that's it.
I'm Jim Malone, and I work the political beat. I cover what drives the political issues in the United States, what voters think, what drives the candidates, how public opinion shifts on one issue or another. It keeps you in touch with the American people and where they want the country to go. It's a great way to get a window on what's happening in the United States. I'm Jim Malone, and my beat is U.S. politics.
My name's Carla Babb, and I work the Pentagon beat. That access helps me to do better stories. Every day it's my responsibility to collect all of the defense news. It keeps our VOA viewers informed. I get to travel all across the globe. Anything that's defense related and how to protect and keep people safe, that's where I'll go. So it's never a dull moment at the Pentagon. My name is Carla Babb. This is my beat.
I'm Roger Muntu. I've been a VOA for about 4 years.